French mathematician René Thom created catastrophe theory in the 1960s. Thom theorized there are two types of processes in nature, continuous and discontinuous. Continuous processes are smooth and easy to predict. For example, your car will get a certain number of miles per gallon of gas until you have to fill up, and your fuel gauge is able to tell you when you're running low. But then there are discontinuous processes. Picture an earthquake. Everything seems cool and nothing really seems like it's changing, but then boom, you have this sudden colossal change, which Thom's theory labels a catastrophe. I would posit that false confessions can be a brilliant illustration of catastrophe theory. You have an innocent person who's brought in for interrogation. They maintain their innocence. The police try every trick in the book to try to coerce a confession. But for a while, nothing seems to work, externally at least. The suspect continues denying involvement and looks like he's not going to crack. But internally, something is cracking. The suspect's confidence. He begins to believe there's no way out, that the officers will keep hammering on him for hours unless he tells them what they want to hear. And then finally, when the officers find just the right thing to say, we have it, a catastrophe, both in terms of the theory and the fate that's about to befall the suspect and the other innocent individuals he might have implicated. In this episode, we're going to drop you right there into the interrogation room for just a portion of a 6.5-hour interrogation with an 18-year-old with a 5th-grade reading level and an IQ that correlates with mild mental retardation. And what we'll believe you'll see by the end of the episode is a real-life catastrophe.
Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Carl Willis and Wayne Braddy. This is the second episode in a 4-episode series about Carl Willis and Wayne Braddy, who were convicted of the 1998 murder of 13-year-old Maurice Purify in Toledo, Ohio. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
To set the stage for the police interrogation of Travis Slaughter, let's refresh your recollection. In the early morning hours of June 15, 1998, 13-year-old Maurice Purify was found dead in Toledo, Ohio. The next day, the Toledo police received a Crime Stoppers call accusing Aaron Pettis of the murder. But despite evidence corroborating that accusation, he was dropped as a suspect after he passed a polygraph test. And that wasn't the only tip that the police received. Exactly 1 month later, on July 15th, the police got another promising-sounding lead. According to a police report, on July 15th, 1998, this detective and Sergeant Forrester met with a confidential informant who stated that he/she was with Purify right before he was murdered. The informant stated that he/she met Purify at the BP station on Detroit Avenue at approximately 02:30 hours, and they went back to a nearby residence. Purify told the informant he was selling crack for Weenie. He stated that he was short and he was afraid that Weenie was going to get him. He further stated he was selling crack out by the Ravella apartments. Weenie was identified as Alan Lyons, who is an alleged member of the mob gang. We have no idea what happened with Weenie, but we do know what happened with the next tip. As noted last episode, someone claiming to be Chandrea Rayford called Crime Stoppers and claimed that Travis Slaughter confessed to murdering Maurice. And when Chandrea herself was not forthcoming, the police decided to go right to the source. On the morning of August 27th, 1998, they went to Travis Slaughter's house to bring him in for questioning. Here's how Travis described that morning to Brian Duggar on WTOL.
And something kept telling me, get out the house. You need to go. Get out the house. You need to get up and leave. Go. Something just kept egging on at me. Like, you need to go. Get out the house. The phone had rung. Cordless phone, right? And I picked it up, and it was static. It said, Travis. I was like, who is this? And click. Right when I set the phone down on the receiver, the door come booming in. Come flying off the hinges. And all I seen was a bunch of men in black with guns and shields and face masks. And all I'm thinking in my mind is, oh, shit. What the fuck is going on? I had no idea at all whatsoever. Like, what? Like, they got the wrong house. They tripping. And they was like, where's the gun? Where's the fucking gun? Where's the gun at this and that? And believe they read me my rights. I don't know. Slammed me to the floor, took me upstairs.
The Toledo police then brought Travis to the police station and put him in the interrogation room where he would spend the next 6+ hours. Travis's primary interrogator was Detective Scott, who began the interrogation by asking Travis how far he went in school.
Okay. You in school?
No, tomorrow.
You graduate?
No.
How far did you go?
7th grade.
10th grade?
Detective Scott then had Travis read a Miranda waiver. That is, a document that would waive his Miranda rights, such as the right to remain silent. Notably, Detective Scott then does not engage in any colloquy with Travis, but instead just tells him to sign the waiver.
You understand all that?
Yeah.
Okay, where it says sign, I need you to sign.
Detective Scott then asks Travis about any friends he has, which leads Travis to explain how, in 2022 parlance, he'd become unfriended.
Who are some of your close buddies that you hang out with? Your closest friends? Your boys, in other words?
I ain't got no friends.
You ain't got no friends?
I used to have friends, but they crossed me and I threatened to kill them.
Detective Scott then proceeds to ask Travis about these former friends of his.
Who are these guys?
One name was Wayne. They called him Wayne Yak, and one name was Dub or Bub.
Dub, by the way, is Carl Willis, with Dub being his nickname based on the first letter of his last name. Detective Slaughter then cuts to the heart of the matter, asking Travis what he knows about the death of Maurice Purify. Travis responds that he didn't know Maurice personally, but he had heard about his murder.
You know he was dead, right?
I heard about it in the paper and stuff.
Huh?
I heard about it in the paper.
Travis says that his mother was especially upset about the murder of a young boy, and so she cut out the article about the crime and put it on the fridge so her sons would read it and steer clear of similar trouble. But, according to Detective Scott, there was trouble between Travis and Maurice before his death. Specifically, a beef.
Well, we understand you had a beef with him.
Say what?
You had a beef with him.
I don't hang around no little kids.
No,
who told you that?
We heard you had a beef with him. Is that correct?
Wrong. I never knew that little kid. But who told you this?
You got some guys that told us a few things.
Now, this is a clear lie by Detective Scott. In fact, the police had no guys and no information about a beef between Travis and Maurice. All they had was the Crime Stoppers call, allegedly made by Chandrea Rayford, about Travis saying he murdered Maurice, which Chandrea refused to corroborate when she spoke to the police and the prosecutor. But despite this police deception, which is lawful, Travis doesn't budge from his position.
I didn't even know that little kid.
You didn't know it.
I'm 18 years old. I began September 6th. What I look like arguing with a little 13 or 12, however old he was, that don't make sense.
Well, a lot of things sometimes don't make sense, but things happen. Right?
Right. But I ain't got nothing to do with that little boy's life, Eddie.
Huh?
I ain't got nothing to do with that little boy's life, Eddie.
You didn't have nothing to do with it?
In response, Detective Scott begins a process that continues over the course of the next several hours. not so subtly suggesting to Travis that they can help him out if he'd only confess to the crime.
You didn't do it.
No.
You're telling me you don't know if you didn't do it, was anyone with you that might have done it, and you're trying to cannot say something? We need to know because it's going to come to light. So if you know something about it and played a part in it, you need to let us know now. That way, something, you know, we can discuss what can be done about it.
But I ain't do it. I ain't got no proof I did.
Huh?
I ain't do it. I ain't no proof that I did.
Ain't no proof you did it.
I wouldn't do nothing like that. Not to no little kids anyway.
Dissatisfied with this response, Detective Scott decides to double down on his deception, telling Travis that they didn't just decide to come to his house today, and that he knows that Travis isn't being totally honest because of the extensive evidence they've gathered against him. Detective Scott is then joined by his tag team partner, Lieutenant Ross, who's even more explicit in his deceit.
It's like Detective Scott said, we did look at you today and decide to go kick in your door and pull you out of there. Okay, this is something we've done for a long time. We've looked at, we've talked to a lot of people, okay? And it's not just one person saying that you were involved with this thing. It's more than one, all right? And we're not here to sit in judgment and decide what happened was right or wrong, but we want to know the truth.
Again, this is completely untrue. The police have exactly one person connecting Travis to the crime. The Crime Stoppers caller claiming to be Chandrea Rayford. When Travis still doesn't budge, Lieutenant Ross resorts to a classic ploy in the Reed technique that's designed to secure confessions, many of them false. Create a narrative that shifts the blame from the suspect in the hopes that he'll adopt it.
And things, see, things happen for a reason. You know what I mean? I mean, he didn't just end up dead because somebody wanted to shoot him. My guess is he probably pissed somebody off. He may have even threatened somebody. You know what I mean? Because yeah. There's always two sides of the story. It's not just his side. It's the side of the person, too. I mean, if he threatened somebody's life and gunfire came out, then that could be a reason for, you know, to have somebody shot. I mean, we need to know what Dory is. And if you were there, like people are saying that you were there, we need to know what happened.
Detective Scott then piggybacks on this narrative bait, continuing the Reed technique with the classic trope of just wanting and needing to hear Travis's side of the story.
We understand things get out of hand when things go to shit. Shit start happening, okay? And that's important, okay? You and Bob, you end up killing a man. If you had a reason to do it, then it need to be told right here.
But I did.
Yeah, people saying you did.
Lieutenant Ross then stitches together two of the threads from before, telling Travis they can help him, but only if he tells his side of the story.
We're kind of at a crossroads right now, okay? We're in a situation where we can help you with this. But if you don't want to help yourself, there's not much else that we can do, all right? If you can tell us the circumstances that were involved, we can look at everything, hear your side of the story.
I don't know nothing about it. I don't know nothing about this little boy. I'm telling y'all the truth.
With yet another denial by Travis, Detective Scott makes a last-ditch effort for Travis to come clean.
If Maurice was out here doing people wrong, screwing up their money, not doing what he's supposed to, and say you approached him and confronted him about how he fucking up, then sometimes things get out of hand. Like my partner said, gunfire just started ringing out. And if you had to do them, you did it. I mean, is it possible something like that could happen with a person?
I mean, that could happen to anyone.
Having failed yet again, Detective Scott hopes the specter of a lie detector test will get Travis to tell the truth.
You ever heard of a polygraph test?
Polygraph.
Lie detector.
No. I mean, I seen it on TV. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to take one of them, though.
You are?
And that's what it's going to take for y'all to believe.
Now, as we noted, Aaron Pettis was a suspect in Maurice's murder before Travis, and based upon much stronger evidence. But he was ruled out after he passed a polygraph test. For whatever reason, though, despite Travis volunteering for a polygraph test, the detectives don't give him one. Instead, they start asking him about another crime he committed.
You realize you have warrants for your arrest, right?
Yeah.
You know what that's all about, right?
One of the warrants deals with you having sex with a girl. You want to tell us about that?
The crime with current warrants for Travis's arrest was rape. Specifically, Travis was alleged to have engaged in sex acts with a 12-year-old. In the interrogation, Travis admitted to having sex with a 12-year-old girl but claimed that she told him she was 16 or 17 years old. After Travis's admission, Detective Scott immediately comes back to Maurice's murder.
Look, man, I'm being straight up with you, okay? If you know something about this boy's death, man, you need to let us know right now before things get out of hand. Now listen to me, son, I'm telling you this, okay? I want you to be 100% straight up with us about this. If you know something about his death, now's the time to tell us. Because later on, stuff go down, and we put a case together, then we ain't going to be trying to listen to nothing you got to say.
All I want to know is who killed him here, this home game fire.
To the untrained ear, this might have seemed like Detective Scott returning to the murder allegation after a non-sequitur detour into the rape rap against Travis. But those familiar with police interrogations would tell you that Detective Scott was implying that they could help Travis with both cases if he just came clean about the murder. And vital to this interrogation tactic is the equivalent of the, quote, act now while supplies last, used in sales promotions.
You know, we're going to continue to work on this, right?
Right.
If so happen to be we build a case against you, we ain't going to be trying to talk to you no more. That's how it is.
I'm lying.
So you saying ain't nothing out there to build a case again, right?
I ain't saying that, but I know I ain't doing. Even God know that.
So again, it's no dice for Detective Scott, and that continues to be the case when Travis seemingly doesn't get a metaphor that he tries to use.
And you're not telling us your side of the story about what happened. You willing to roll the dice like that and take the real blunt of what's going to happen?
I don't like dice. I don't even shoot dice, but...
But I'm saying, are you willing to take those chances?
No.
You know what an indictment is? When you get indicted by a grand jury?
With Detective Scott again failing to make headway, he decides to up the deceit ante.
What if I tell you people, steady callers, giving us the information? I negate the option here.
Probably because they want to see me locked up.
Some of the stuff they're saying, they're saying it's true, that we know it's true. It's making a whole lot of sense.
This fabrication is then followed by an Emmy-worthy performance by Lieutenant Ross, who returns to the interrogation room after stepping out for a few minutes.
Well, the weekend.
A weekend?
Probably. I'm sure.
Yes, Lieutenant?
The informant just called. And it's right on. He either knows, he either did it, or he knows who did it. We're going to quit screwing around with him. If he ain't going to tell you the truth, let's call the prosecutor and just charge him with it and be done with it. He either tells you the truth, or that's it. We're going to quit screwing with him. We spent enough time, we wasted enough time. If he ain't going to be honest with you, the hell with him.
Okay. I'm being honest with you.
No, you're not being honest with him. If you don't tell him the truth, then we're just going to
go. I'm being honest with you, though.
Okay.
Now, you likely already figure this out, but just in case, no. Lieutenant Ross did not miraculously get a smoking gun call in the middle of the interrogation, And no, they didn't call the prosecutor. Detective Scott then proceeds to try to get Travis to admit to Maurice's murder, but instead, Travis starts talking about other crimes that he's committed.
No, I never shot nobody. I've been arrested for arson and stuff like that, setting stuff on fire.
Do you understand what I was telling you about? Cooperation. Cooperation, when you cooperate, it goes a long way.
I mean, it ain't my fault. I don't know nothing about this kid's murder. I don't know why I'm accused for things I ain't do.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why I'm getting accused of things I ain't do.
Detective Scott's plea regarding the benefits of cooperation does lead to an admission about the arson, not the murder.
What are you on probation for?
For arson. Because I had set this lady yard on fire and blew up her car.
Did you do that intentionally or was it an accident? Or?
I mean, I did it with a friend because this lady, she used to always tell on us, get us in trouble and things like that.
So it was kind of a revenge type of thing?
Yeah.
This admission leads Lieutenant Ross to question Travis about what led him to commit crimes, and he responds that he was abused by his birth mother and then put in foster homes where he was abused more. For Travis, one act of abuse by his mother stood out.
At the age of seven, when I was about 5 years old, she took my finger and set them over the eye. Cause I couldn't say my ABC and
So that was her way of punishing you?
I was slow at the time and she used to take little knives and cut me cause I got a real little cut right here.
She wasn't very patient with you, was she?
Lieutenant Ross then takes Travis through different ways in which he's been abused and mistreated throughout his life, and then tries to convince him that, by way of contrast, his interrogating officers have treated him very fairly. Travis responds that he doesn't know because he's easily misled. Seemingly seizing on this, Lieutenant Ross makes an especially bold attempt to mislead Travis.
You understand nobody wants to throw you in jail and throw the key away. You understand that, don't you?
Yes.
There's always light at the end of the tunnel. No matter how bleak or how dark things look now, there's always light at the end of the tunnel. Do you believe that?
Yes.
I believe that also. And you have to understand that it's in the best interest of this police department to get you out any jam you're in, all right?
All right.
Get you straightened around in that. But you have to do something on your part.
Well, they're trying to make me admit to something I ain't doing.
What do they want you to admit to?
12-year-old murder.
Okay.
That I don't know nothing about. I never knew this kid. I never met him.
When Travis still won't give in, Lieutenant Ross again invents witnesses to try and get Travis to relent.
Okay, but obviously there are people that are telling the police department something else, all right?
And that's the main problem.
Well, the main problem is that they know things that nobody else knows, and they would have had to learn from whoever did this bad thing, all right?
With Travis remaining steadfast in his denials, Lieutenant Ross tries a different tactic, getting Travis to believe that he's carrying a huge burden and he just wants him to get right with God.
But then when it's all over, when the smoke clears, and after you've had some rest, then you think, my God, what did I do? And then that's when it gets heavy. That's when it gets real heavy. And we don't want that for you. All right? We don't want that on your shoulders. It weighs your heart down. And you don't want to face the Lord with that on your conscience ever.
And according to Lieutenant Scott, it's more than just the police trying to help Travis. He claims that the people implicating him in the crime also express concern for him.
Not only do they care about the victim, but they care about you. You as a person. And what could happen to you if you continue along this way without getting the truth out, getting this behind you, getting rehabilitated. They're worried of what's going to happen to you. and they've expressed that to us.
Toledo don't got the death penalty, do I?
No. The state of Ohio decides if somebody dies. But we don't even want to seek that, all right? We don't even want to talk about that. You're too young. We'd rather see you get the truth out and become rehabilitated. And that's why people who've told us didn't do it out of anger or meanness or want to see you get locked up the rest of your life or something like that, but out of concern, out of love for you too. And that's why we want to help yourself. We're not the only ones concerned about you.
Thereafter, over the next hour or so, Lieutenant Scott throws everything he can at Travis. This includes saying the following things. We're here out of concern for you. Don't let the evil consume you, because it will eat you up until you are no more. This is going to kill you. You're slowly going to die. You're going to have psychotic episodes and things like that. We're not going to let anything bad happen to you. We want to help you. None of it works, but then, finally, Lieutenant Ross finds the right talking point.
But somebody showed you the wrong way in this thing, and you're afraid to tell us about it. And we understand that, but we don't want to give up on you. If we walk out of this room, say all the hell with him, let him face the consequences, however, that's kind of like throwing you to the dogs, and we don't want to do that.
And with that, Travis finally opens up. He says he didn't murder Maurice, but he saw him being killed.
No, I didn't kill
him. Okay, who did?
I don't know. That's the only problem.
Who are you with?
I seen him get killed, but I ain't...
You saw him get killed? All right, tell us about that. You mind if I get my notepad?
No, I don't mind.
All right, I'll be right back. I want you to tell me what you saw.
According to Travis, he was near Robinson Junior High School at the time of the murder and saw someone shoot Maurice, but he couldn't make the man out because he was wearing a mask.
I don't know who killed.
We know. You know. Yes, you do. Did you have on a mask that night, Travis?
No.
Nobody had a mask on, did they?
Yeah. The person that killed me had a mask.
All right. Were you going to rob him?
I wasn't going to do nothing to him. I ain't had no reason to rob him. I was working at the time.
And then, if you believe that Wayne Brady and Carl Willis were wrongfully convicted of murdering Maurice, this is a key moment in the interrogation.
This guy that you say shot him. You recognize him?
No, not really.
Well, I mean, what you mean not really? Do you recognize him, Craig?
I ain't seen his face. I just seen his height.
What do you think it was?
The only person I know about that height is one dude named Wayne.
Wayne who?
Wayne Brady. They call
him
Wayne.
Now, notably, Travis is not saying that Wayne murdered Maurice. Just that the masked man who did kill him was roughly the same height as Wayne. This is something picked up on by Detective Scott, but it doesn't go the way he had hoped.
A normal human being, okay? Look at this, okay? You going by a person's height, and you said you felt it was him, basically, right?
Right.
So that tells me you had some other reason to think it was him. Either you know it was him, or you saw that it was him.
Right.
Or you and him were involved, or you and him did this.
Yeah, I don't even get along with my enemy.
He's your enemy, why?
I don't like me.
And from there, it just gets worse for Detective Scott.
Was it Wayne?
No.
Huh?
No, because I ain't for sure. I judge that man by his height. I could have been anybody.
With Travis saying that Wayne didn't murder Maurice, Lieutenant Ross gets more direct, accusing Travis of the murder.
You can't even tell us why you did it. You can't even explain it to yourself. Maybe you were high, I don't know.
There's a lot you can say.
Don't tell me that. I don't accept that. He don't accept it either.
I definitely don't.
I don't accept that I killed him. I don't know who killed him.
You killed him. I'm done about that. Why? I don't think you can even tell us why. I don't think it's something you planned to do. It just jumped off. It was there haunting you the next morning. It's been haunting you ever since.
With Travis still refusing to confess, the officers leave him alone for a minute, and he says the following prayer.
Looking for a comrade to draw courage again. Forgive me for all this cussing, Jesus. Oh, why, God, please help me. Get me out of this, God. I didn't do it. You know that, Father.
Now, in case you couldn't make out what Travis was saying, he was asking God to get him out of this because he didn't do it. But of course, when the officers come in after remotely hearing what Travis said, they turn his prayer against him. First, when Travis again denies killing Maurice, Lieutenant Ross says that he's not being honest and that, quote, in that short little prayer, you were honest. That's the only honesty, full honesty, in here demonstrated today. And then there's this by Detective Scott.
You told yourself that you did it.
No, I did.
Right there on the tape.
I was asking God, why did they pick me? Why am I going through this over something I didn't do?
But despite Travis's explanation of the purpose of his prayer, it soon becomes clear that the officers have him. They're claiming he's confessed. And now there's really no way out of the situation. And so, a third unnamed officer is brought in to create a new narrative that Travis can adopt.
Now, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. You and Bud and Wayne are together. Are you given instructions by somebody to go find Maurice? Or did you just find Maurice walking? Is there an argument between the two of you?
No.
Is there an argument between him and Bud?
No.
What about him and Wayne?
No.
Then what happened? What made them angry enough that they beat him up and shot him? What made him mad? Did he diss him?
Probably.
Well, you were there, you tell me, did he diss him? You heard the conversation, you know, I wasn't there. You have to fill in the blanks. Remember, you keep telling me you want to do the right thing. Is that right?
Now, to be clear, this narrative comes entirely from this closer, not from Travis. At this point, Travis has named Carl and Wayne as former friends, said that he saw a masked man who was roughly the same height as Wayne shoot Maurice, but he couldn't say that it was Wayne who shot him for sure, and that Wayne and he wouldn't commit the crime together because they were basically frenemies at this point. But now this new officer is telling Travis that he, Wayne, and Carl ran into Maurice, with Wayne and Carl killing Maurice because he dissed them. Then the closer adds pressure to this narrative, telling Travis that if he doesn't rat out Wayne and Carl, they will turn on him.
We go pick up the other two. The first thing they're gonna say is, he shot it. He had the gun. He had the gun.
I wish I knew who these suspects were.
You do know who they are. You know everything.
I don't.
Oh yeah, you have all the power. You got all the power, but you're gonna lose it.
And then, after pushing home this point more powerfully, Travis finally does give in.
There are two men walking around here who are involved with this. You're the only one sitting here. But we will get them today. Now, do you want me? Do you want them to tell us first? Do you want them to say that it was you?
No.
I think you do. How much longer do you think it's gonna take? Why do you think you're here?
God
put you here. He sure did.
He's working now, that's what's going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Who are the other two people?
Wayne and Carl.
And then, after Travis gives the closer their names, the closer starts feeding Travis a narrative that he can fill in.
What did they do? Who held him?
Wayne.
Wayne held Maurice? What did he do?
He had him by his arms up in the air. And Maurice was sitting on the ground with his arms was up in the air. And they told me to look up. If I didn't look up, they said they were going to kill me.
Okay. I believe that. Go ahead.
But now things get tricky, because the closer is no longer leading Travis, and he has to come up with details on his own. Like this.
Carl was kicking him in the stomach and started punching on me, talking about where my money at.
He owed Carl money for what?
I don't know. I think Carl owed him. I think Marie owed Carl some drug money.
This is notable because it's the first detail that Travis gives about the murder, and it's a detail that, as we'll note next episode, he completely changes at trial. But he then gives out one of the few details that remain consistent across all of his stories.
And then Carl said, bring him over here, and he brought him by a tree. And Wayne had him by this, up in the air, because Maurice's feet was on the ground. He was like this, but his hands up in the air, he was dragging his feet, trying to kick and stuff and make him get off of him. So then Maurice was like, get off of me, man, get off of me, this and that. Y'all let me go. All y'all done, I do nothing. Y'all get off of me, this and that.
This image of Maurice being dragged over to a tree after being roughed up is vivid. But it's also completely unsupported by the evidence. At trial, Dr. Cynthia Besser, a forensic pathologist, would testify that there was no sand or dirt in Maurice's wounds, indicating that he was not dragged across the ground. And then there was the shooting. Travis claims that Carl shot Maurice, a claim that will mutate into something very different at trial. Moreover, here's what Travis says about the gun that Carl used to shoot him.
Describe the gun to me that Carl shot him with.
It was chrome and black. It had a black handle with rust up on.
You know what the caliber it was?
What that mean?
What size? You know, like a 9 or something like that? What size was it?
I think it was a 380.
Wrong again. According to the state's firearms expert, the shell casings recovered from the crime scene were fired from a Raven 25, not a 380. So, how about the clothes that Maurice was wearing?
Okay, let's go back to Maurice. Tell me exactly what Maurice was wearing.
That night he had on a red t-shirt and black shorts.
Black shorts. Tell me about the shorts, what they look like.
They was kind of long. They went past his knees.
And again, Travis is wrong. Maurice was not wearing a red t-shirt and baggy shorts. Instead, he was found wearing a black and brown checkered shirt over a white t-shirt and black denim pants with a blue belt.
But none of that matters to the officers. They're thrilled that they've gotten a confession, and they reward Travis with food and drink.
You need anything to drink, pop or anything?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll get you a pop.
Want anything to eat?
You hungry?
Want us to get you something to eat? You like burgers?
Yeah.
All right, we'll take care of it.
But after the officers leave, the tape keeps rolling. and you can see the human toll that a coerced confession can cause.
Damn, man. Damn. The fuck, man? Damn. How the fuck I'ma tell, man? Motherfucking family about to be in some shit. Fucking family might... I ain't gonna think like that. Knock on wood. Damn, man. Hold on now to my people. Please, God, please protect my family. Man, put this cigarette down. Shit crazy. Please, God, don't let that... Please protect my family, Jesus. Even though I know I'ma do some time. But God, listen, I refuse to do time, Jesus. I refuse to let them sentence me with, I don't care if it's 6 months. God, I refuse to go back to jail. They might put me in jail, God, but I won't be in there for long. Please forgive me for me gonna kill myself. Please forgive me, God. That's the only way I see out of it, suicide. Amen.
That wasn't too bad, kiddo. You had to do what you gotta do. I told you that from the get-go, didn't I?
Yeah.
Alrighty. Just relax.
But is Travis suicidal because he'd just given a false confession, or because he'd given the real McCoy?
Yeah, I had got loaded. The day before August 27th, I just got sloppy, nasty, pissy drunk, high as a bird, and I woke up with a hangover August 27th.
Next time. On Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Of course, I'd like to thank our sponsors. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and you can support our Patreon @UndisclosedPod.